Hi there and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years and I'm fascinated by how the companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them and the business people and managers that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado to today's episode. Village Vets is Ireland's largest privately owned vet-led veterinary group, delivering premium companion animal care to communities across the country. Founded on clinical excellence and local ownership, Village Vets has grown into a market-leading organisation, caring for hundreds of thousands of pets every year, supported by a nationwide team of veterinary surgeons, nurses, animal care teams and specialists. Alongside its clinics, Village Vet also owns and operates Paw Prince Crematorium, Ireland's largest pet cremation service, supporting both the public and the veterinary practices nationwide. Charles Cosgrave is the CEO and owner of Village Vets and one of the most experienced vet entrepreneurs in the Irish veterinary sector. He began his veterinary career in a busy small animal hospital in Limerick, followed by a year in a high-volume multi-site practice in the UK before joining Village Vets in 2003, a business founded in 1980 by his father, Carl, who also is a vet. Today, he leads the strategic development of the group with responsibility for business growth, clinical expansion and long-term platform strategy. Charles, you are very welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
Right. As a starting point, tell me how Village Vets began.
Well, began with my dad, Carl, back in 1980. He came back. He was working up the north and then did a stint in Mayo and came back to Dunboyne, where I live now. And he also lives. And he acquired a practice in Dunshaughlin. And that's really where it started with Dad. It was at the time Dunshaughlin was a very rural town, very agricultural community, lots of farmers, lots of dairy herds there. So his veterinary practice was very much agricultural based. Mm-hmm. But as the city expanded and as the years went by, more and more pets. And then obviously people became more focused around their pets, became more caring about their pets. And that's really how the practice evolved from my dad's side. I grew up with veterinary in the house. Myself and my sister both went on to do veterinary in college, very lucky to get in there. And we grew up on a farm. We had a dairy farm at home as well. But we grew up at veterinary around the kitchen table. It was 24/7. Christmas Day was, my dad was on call. We'd go out on calls with him on Christmas Day and Christmas dinner. Well, we had Christmas dinner whenever.
On the hoof almost.
Oh, pretty much, yeah, yeah. It was very much so, you know, it was whenever the work was done, we had the Christmas dinner. So as a result, we rarely had guests on Christmas Day. It was only our grandparents, mum and dad's parents, because they knew the dynamic. But you couldn't really invite people to the house
and not know when you're getting back.
You know, they wouldn't know when you're getting fed. So it was, so we grew up with that. And as time went on, I became more interested in veterinary, and mum and dad did encourage us to look at other disciplines, other professions, other jobs, other careers throughout school. But the whole way I kept being brought back to veterinary myself. And when it came to doing my leaving for the first time, did it twice, I only had one choice down in my CAO form, and that was veterinary. So it was veterinary or burst. So I went back into the leaving the second time. and that's how I ended up being a vet and, coming around to where we ended up in veterinary, essentially, you know.
And then, you know, coming back into Village Vets after your few stints around, where was your thought process to say, well, we've got one facility, I suppose, turning it into a business as opposed to just a practice?
Yeah, it was, when I was in the UK, I worked in a practice in the UK that had a few different sites, and I could see the how that worked and how, you know, when you expanded your client base and you're in various different locations, you would have a critical mass to provide more advanced services because you'd have more cases coming through, say in ophthalmology, dealing with eye cases or skin or cardiology, whatever it might be, you'd have a wider pool of clients. And as a result, the vet became more experienced in that area, and they started only working in that area, not doing maybe sort of not doing surgery because they were specialising in cardiology. And I could see how multi-site businesses would become a thing of the future, where you would have people becoming more specialised in these niche areas, and clients then would get a higher level of service, pets would get a higher level of care, and there'd be ultimately be, there would be better outcomes for pets. And that's, that wasn't here in Ireland at the time. And I remember coming home and going, that is something that we should be doing here. You know, Ireland is oftentimes, you know, we're behind the curve compared to the UK or the States. Certainly so in veterinary, although that bridge has that deficit has closed now. But that was something I thought we could emulate here. And I suppose it was ambition combined with blind optimism, or maybe foolishness.
That's naivety is always great.
Naivety is great, yeah. And I said, why can't we do that? And that's where it was born out of trying to expand our client base, and then be able to expand the amount of people who worked within the practice to be able to provide those services. And that's where the evolution of Village Vets as a group came from, as a bigger practice came from.
And did your dad think you were crazy?
No. Did he agree with me? No. Did he think it was crazy? No. But look, I suppose here was I coming back from the UK, you know, like I was late 20s. I was still a child in his eyes. I'm still a child in his eyes. You know, I'm nearly 50 years of age now. And so there was, you know, it was definitely a journey. Coming back and trying to create that entity while not being the owner, still working with my dad, and and trying to execute that vision, you know, without insulting him, without stepping on his toes, or undermining the tremendous work that he had done down through the years, which was amazing. And I was very fortunate to be allowed into that. But yeah, there was a journey there for both of us to go on to try and achieve that. And he was hugely supportive, was a critical foundation piece of that.
And when you go back to that stage, you know, in terms of veterinary training and university and things like that, I suppose to use the medical analogy, correct me if I'm wrong, but vets were much more GPs then than specialist consultants as they came out. So has the veterinary education system moved to be that kind of, well, you train as a kind of a general vet, and then you specialize, and then you're finding positions within the broader scope of something like Village Vets that, you know, as you said, might need a cardiologist, I might need an ophthalmologist, I might need whatever.
Yeah, like your veterinary degree, and it remains so to this day, not just in Ireland, across the world, predominantly is multi-species and a very generalist qualification. So you're a general practitioner across cats, dogs, cattle, horses, sheep, et cetera, and that, you know, you need to go out and find your niche, find your groove. Are you going to work with small animals? Are you going to work with cattle? Are you going to work with horses? And then are you going to be a general practitioner for that species, or are you going to specialise even further again? So there is quite a journey to go on after you leave university to try and find out where you're going to be and how are you going to upskill in that area. And that's equally as long a journey as the 5 or 6 year qualification it takes to get your basic veterinary degree.
Right. And, you know, you obviously operate that kind of scalable multi-format growth model, right? And you know, it's very disciplined in terms of the acquisitions and also combining it with organic growth. But why do you think that model works?
I think for a multitude of reasons. I think the first one is that it's very much driven by client demand, by the pet owner demand. So pets have now become part of the family. They're sleeping in our beds. They're on our screensaver on our phones. They're on their desktop, on our PCs. Family photos don't go by without a picture of the pet in them. And I know that from personal experience, and then also from our clients coming in. And pet owners want human grade care for their pet. And so they want the Beacon, the Hermitage, the Blackrock treatment for their pet, and they want it now. And we are nearly chasing that. We're chasing that sort of supply side of that service where, you know, they're wondering, why can't they do a niche service here in Village Vet? Mm. You know, why don't you have a CT scanner? We have a CT scanner, but, you know, before we had it, we had to refer them out. So they were demanding of those services. And then you also have TV shows that are coming from larger countries where they have a wider range of veterinary services available. And they get clients are getting exposed to that, and then coming to us.
Blame that other Mead man for that, by the way.
And so we're very much been led by our clients in terms of what they demand for their pets. Secondly, is that there is huge advances in treatment modalities, technology, equipment within veterinary over the past number of years. And if I look at sort of, I'm out of college just over 20 or nearly 20 years. And the first half of my career after college, the pace of change was fine. It wasn't anything remarkable. I think in the second half of my career, it has been breakneck speed. You every time we go to a trade show, there is something where you go, oh my God,
I could use one of them,
or like, how did they invent that? Or it's just incredible. So I think that is providing faster access for pet owners to more advanced care. And oftentimes what we would consider, it's still expensive, but it's more affordable care. And it delivers better outcomes for pets. So I think there's an advancement in the technology and the modalities being invented, and there's also an increased demand from pet owners, because pets are just becoming more important. They're just becoming another member of the family.
And does that mean then that ultimately the game within Village Vesting is that you're going to have certain practices that are just dedicated cardiologist or dedicated thing, whereby, you know, it doesn't matter if I'm in Raheny and I go to the Village Vets in Raheny and I find out my dog is a cardiac issue, you go, you need to go and see our cardiologist who's in somewhere else, that you're optimizing the network, if you will, to certain specific locations that have skill sets.
Exactly. So what we do is we'll have people located in the Village Vets clinic, so say Raheny is your broad for an example, and that there'll be a niche skill set based there. And because of the level of equipment and technology or services that are required to facilitate a vet doing that work, the skill set or the service is based there. Mm-hmm. It's generally not mobile. So people travel for that particular service. Now, you might only travel once in your dog's lifetime, but at least you know that all your history, the handover from the vet, is still within that the Village Vet communication system. And that makes it easier for clients to move over there, but also the communication of previous health conditions, any nuances that, you know, are on a vet-to-vet basis around the health of the pet or the circumstance of the condition, that can be managed a lot more seamlessly. So the handover of a case in both directions is a lot easier. And also it gives the client the reassurance that it's still within that same culture, that same ethos, mm-hmm. that same envelope of care that we provide. So, you know, we're open 24/7. We have 3 24-hour centres. And clients like that reassurance that they, if they're based in Raheny, they can go to a Village Vets 24-hour centre if something happens at 3 o'clock in the morning. And then the following day, they're still back in Raheny to see Sorka, so who's the local vet there. So it's really about building that sort of community of care, that community of services, so that when a pet needs something that is very rare, very niche, and might only happen once in their lifetime, or maybe even once in the lifetime of a family who have had multiple pets, at least we can do it straight away or as quickly as possible, because it's a Village Vets client and it's in a Village Vets clinic.
And how many clinics have you got now?
We've got 35.
Okay, around the country.
Yeah.
Now, and in a similar way, as you're building up those specialisms and become renowned for those specialists? Are you getting referrals from other vets who are, you know, might be on their own and kind of, look, I think it's this, but you need to go and talk to the village vet cardiologist, I'll make the referral?
Yeah, so look, we open our services to everybody. We're not village vets specific. So it's important that people have access to good care. But likewise, we're cognizant of that B2B relationship. So we're very cognizant of handing that client back when we've done our particular piece of that puzzle, that we can hand the case back and say, we're handing Nelly over. This is what we found. This is the treatment course that we recommend. And we think you guys can take it from here. So that relationship belongs to the referring vet. And that's ultimately where the pet has started their journey with that vet, whether it's in village vets or elsewhere. And that's where that trust is built up. And, you know, we need to, that's the most important thing in human to doctor, pet owner to vet. That's really, really important.
And, you know, going back to when you came back and you're talking to your dad about this, and you know, there's always that intergenerational conflict, and going, are you mad type stuff? But at that stage, did you think there'd be 35 sites? Or did you say, no, 35 sites, we'll get that, and it'll be only the first stop on a much longer one?
I think we started with the goal of being 10 sites.
All right, okay.
And when we got close to there, we stretched it again. So it was myself, my sister at that point, involving dad, albeit at he had stepped back from the business at that point. And we'd Aoife and Zoe and a few others that are still in the business. And as we got close to the goal, we stretched it out again and said, look, we're onto something here. And if we expand to 15, we'll have a greater pool of clients to provide these extra services. So it was all about how can we provide a higher level of service to our clients and keep it within the village vet's envelope so we can maintain that continuity of care, maintain that quality, and attract a higher caliber of vet. Because as you get into those niche services, you know, the people that are able to deliver it become few and far between. And we really wanted to get the best quality vets and nurses and animal care teams around to be able to deliver those services to our clients and, again, provide those better outcomes for pets. So that comes with scale, that comes with critical mass, but we never wanted to be the biggest organisation. We know that what we're trying to build is a boutique-style veterinary group that's able to provide all those services but still maintain that culture, that vision, that ambition, that sort of agility to be able to move and pivot and see the changing demands of pet owners, the evolution of technologies or the evolution of different modalities of treatment within veterinary, and be agile enough to act upon them and be able to deliver them. And sometimes it doesn't work out. And if it doesn't work out, we should be agile enough to pull the plug and say, do you know what, this isn't working. We need to change, we need to stop, we need to relook at it. And that's what I'm very cognizant of trying to preserve, trying to maintain that culture.
And when you do both greenfield and acquisition, talk me through the decision one or the other in terms of, you know, as you look at it from a strategic setup, what are the criteria that will lean you one way or the other at a certain location?
I suppose for greenfield for us is setting up a brand new veterinary clinic in a retail unit in a community. In a community somewhere. And what we look at is there an opportunity for us to deliver our quality of veterinary within that community? And is there someone doing it really well there already? And if so, right, like, you know, they're doing a great job, let's leave it alone. If there's an opportunity to go into an area where A, there's a lack of services, or B, there's an opportunity to provide the type of care that we do, then we'll look for a unit and we'll spend time getting the right place. And sometimes, I know one particular site took us 10 years, one particular area took us 10 years to find the right place. With an acquisition, it kind of falls into two, with the greenfield, I'll come back to it in a second, but with the acquisitions, again, it's about finding a clinic with the right culture, with the right approach to veterinary and clients, and do they fit what we're trying to do? And, you know, is it the, does it complement our network? Does it complement our skill set? Does it complement our footprint geographically? And will the team there enjoy working with us? And is there synergies there? Is there sort of a commonalities that we can harness? And sometimes it's a lot in the unsaid. It's kind of something you can't put your finger on. But after sort of multiple meetings and sort of getting to know each other, you generally find that common ground. Or sometimes you don't, and sometimes you say, do you know what, this isn't going to be for both of us, and you dismount gracefully. But where you do have that, it becomes very synergistic. It's very beneficial. A lot of the headaches they have, we can take off them. We can allow them to, we can allow them just to do veterinary and not have any sort of the administrative task. But also we can complement what they're doing. Sometimes bring in new services for them, and again enhance their offering. Some of the people who join Village Vet stay on as an equity owner in their practice still, and similarly in our greenfield sites, where the practicing vet there actually has an ownership stake in the practice there. So you spoke about Village Vet Rohini. Sorka is the local vet. There's the lead vet in that clinic. She's a part owner.
And how, because I always say to people, you know, when you're looking at businesses, right, if you want somebody to act like an owner of the business, you got to make them an owner of the business. So how important do you think that equity ownership is in the unique selling point of Village Vet to either a greenfield vet coming in or somebody that you're going to acquire?
Well, I think it's huge. If I take it from the vet's perspective first, is that it's a very high cost entry. It's the opportunities to set up your own veterinary practice and make a real success of it are challenging. And then also the you still have to run. You're a business owner with all the headaches that you take home at 7 o'clock when you close the door, or 8 o'clock. And we're able to centralize them. We're able to deliver support services into an owner like that at a very low cost compared to if they had to do it on their own. But also culturally, clinically, for the team there is a huge benefit to have someone on site that has an ownership stake that elevates that level of care, client experience, and lives and walks and breathes the values of Village Vets and creates their own values within their own clinic. You know, so it's not they take our values and they take our culture. They create their own in that site, and that's felt by the clients. And we're very, very choosy about the people we partner with. They have to be the right people who do it for the right reasons. And we've got tremendous partners there that in that have an ownership stake in their clinics, and they're just the level of care and compassion that they have, and it just, you know, as we always talk about it the whole time, is do the right thing. Always, you know, if you do the right veterinary or do the right medicine, do the right surgery, everything else takes care of itself. And you get the communication piece right. You talk to the owner the whole time and guide them through every step of the journey, whether it's a simple journey like a preventative healthcare visit, or it's a very complicated one like cancer or cardiology or whatever it is. And it's getting that right. And when that comes together, it's just magic.
And what's the essence of the culture then within Village Vets?
I think it's about, again, going back to that, doing that. We're very collaborative, very supportive. It's a huge team, and kind of I don't like it is a family, but I hate using that because it comes across as being a bit trite. But essentially, like, we've come from being a family business, so I know what being a family that family culture means. But it's a very team-based, collaborative culture across
community
all the clinics.
Almost
100%.
Yeah.
But it's that care and compassion that, by, you know, our closing times are 7 o'clock. But if someone walks in at 5 to 7 that needs an emergency surgery, it just gets done.
Right.
And that's the type of culture that you it's hard to create, you know, and it's hard to imbue that into the team. And it's just, I'm so proud of looking at the vets and nurses and care teams that do that late at night and put themselves out for a greater good. And it's about making lives better for the pets that come in. And if it's the right thing to do at that time, it'll be done. Mm. And I think that's, I've got a long-winded way around trying to describe a culture here. But yeah.
But the other thing is you're kind of known for your kind of clear and practical approach to scaling the healthcare business. But behind that is, and I suppose, in different businesses, I've always asked this question, you know, as you get bigger, there's always a risk of distraction or a risk that service level falls or things like that. But you are adamant that clinical standards, the culture, the local identity has to be protected no matter how many sites you're operating on.
Absolutely. Like that local culture is really important. And we're very keen, as a support function, I'm a support function of the clinics now. I am a vet. I still say I'm a vet, but I'm a non-practicing vet.
So. I was going to ask you, do you ever get back to the shop floor?
I'll tell you a story about that in a second. But so we're a support function. We're not there to get in the way. And it's very important that those clinics create their own culture within Village Vets, create their own identity. And that's very community-based. Like what works well in Dublin mightn't work well in Meath, and it certainly probably won't work well in Cork, and vice versa. So there's all that local dynamics that are only understood by that local team, and that is golden. And if you interfere with that and try and create a cut and paste approach to it, it's going to crash and burn. I agonise over client experience. It is the one thing that. One of the things that keeps me awake at night is making sure we get that right. And to your point, as you scale, is trying to maintain that. And we've a wonderful head of client experience, Alan, who is that's his essence. And if you met him, he embodies client experience wonderfully. And he minds that, he trains for that. We're constantly trying to make sure that we nurture that plant. It's a flower, and. You know, it doesn't take much for it to wilt. It's a very fragile entity, and we're always minding that with kid gloves. It's so, so important to us. And the flip side of that is that clinical culture, that clinical excellence. And we have a chief clinical officer, Zoe, and she is responsible for that. Our clinical standards are how we make sure we get it right all the time. And we have our client, our teams trained up to work at the top of their license, making sure that they are fully aware of all the different options available. And if something happens, if we don't get it right or something doesn't go our way, what can we learn from it? You know, and sometimes the body doesn't heal the way you want it to do. And it's despite the best interventions, it may not work. But there's always something that we can take from that afterwards. So it's very... Zoe's doing a huge job on that, and and that sits entirely separate to the commercial aspect of the practice. You know, it has to be that is the core of what we do. It is the essence of what we do, and that is really, really important. I'm really proud of it. It's a USP to what we do to have. A chief clinical officer, but also a whole medical team that sits with Zoe to deliver that clinical excellence every day.
Yeah. Talk to me then in terms of you know, when it comes to staffing and things like that. Are you more a hire from without or develop from within?
Both.
Okay.
Both. I think it's really, really important to think if I taking skills from within. I think. It's really important to take people, especially people who have travelled, who've been in bigger hospitals in larger countries, and especially in cities. I think they come back with a huge skill set that is sometimes harder to achieve here, or sometimes doesn't exist here. So I think that it's important to get that mix coming through. It's invigorating. It's inspirational. To work alongside some people like that. But also we're very proud of bringing people through our organisation who have Some of them have come in as students, you know, veterinary students or nursing students, and they've gone on to either be a partner in their own clinic, an owner in their own clinic, or they've gone to very senior roles that are non-clinical now, having gone through the clinical journey. So it's like Eva, our head of partnerships, she came in as a vet, went on to be an area manager, then went on to be part of the medical team, the clinical team, had various different roles. We've had we have nurses in the organisation now that are in a managerial role or a supervisory role or an education role. So we're very proud of those people coming through the organisation over the years. And a lot of our support team that sit in our, we've an office based in Blanchardstown, our head office is based there where all our support functions are, and a lot of our support functions worked in the clinic. Mm-hmm. So they know
how the clinic works.
And they know when someone rings what's important. Mm. You know, so if someone says a light bulb in reception has gone, or a light bulb in the consult room has gone, they're LED bulbs, so I'm not simplifying it here, but if they know that's really important, because that's a complete distraction to the client experience and to the team working there. Whereas if it's a light gone in the storeroom, okay, we'll get to that, you know. But if it's in the consult room, we get someone out there straight away. So it's knowing that dynamic, it's knowing the disruption. Because they've worked in the clinic, they know the impact of their support is to that clinic. And it's lovely to see that.
The shop floor. I want to hear the shop floor story.
Oh, geez, it's a tough one. I don't do a lot of veterinary anymore, but we had a wonderful dog, Nellie. She's 14, and she was diagnosed with liver cancer about 4 months ago. And she was in and out of the clinic, or out of Ayres Clinic in Ashburn, over the last couple of weeks for 24-hour care. And so she was in for 24 hours at the weekend, and we took her home on Monday, and we put her to sleep on Tuesday night at home with the kids. So being a vet at home, I was able to do it at home myself. But yeah, putting your own dog to sleep is probably the hardest thing I'll ever do. It's a hard job regardless.
Yeah.
Doing it to your own dog in front of the kids, in front of family. Yeah. And, I probably lost my own body weight in tears, to be honest, and the kids the same. But yeah, it was a tough one.
What do you think is the hardest job as a CEO in the business?
The hardest job is getting the balance right. There's a lot of sacrifices to be made, the sacrifices at work, the sacrifice at home, the sacrifices friends, personal life, it's a tough balance to get, and I haven't got it right. I have a wonderful supportive family at home who are sometimes neglected. I think my wife sometimes thinks she's solo parenting, you know. She just probably doesn't think it, she knows it. It's making sure that you can give everything, all of your attention, all the time, and you can't. It's really, really hard, and you have to make decisions that you hope are right. You've got to trust your gut. It's not always. As a vet, I'm scientifically trained, so you're very much about the data. Mm. You know, what does the data tell? And we make our decisions based on data. So, you know, if a patient comes in, you make your decision based on data through diagnostic tests. As a CEO, I'm kind of wired like that.
But so I actually have that question. Are you a database or a gut feel decision maker?
I'm both. I have to be both now, you know, because sometimes there is no data. Sometimes you do have to go with your gut feel. Yeah. And sometimes people come with ideas and I just go, that's just not right, you know. And I've had that before where I've overruled decisions based on gut feel because I just know it's not. I knew it wasn't going to work. Mm. I try not to be a micromanager. I try and empower people to make their own decisions and to make their own mistakes, because that's how we all learn. Mm. But at the same time, there's sometimes you have to pull a rank, and I don't like doing it.
Right. And so in the same regard, are you a fast or slow decision maker?
Depends on who you ask. I'm getting faster. Right. I would have been slow, but I think, and I would have been in the detail too much. And I've got better at that, at extracting myself from the detail.
But do you obsess about the small things still?
I obsess about client experience and clinical care.
Right.
Yeah, 100%. And whether if that gets me into the small things, yes, the answer is yes. Mm. Do I get into the small things of everything? No. I think if I say this once a day, I say it 10 times a day, it's make the big thing the big thing. Mm-hmm. So what is the big thing? If someone comes with a problem, what is the big thing and how does this affect it? And if it does affect it, let's sort it out. If it doesn't affect the big thing, it's not important. Mm-hmm. So I have to remind myself of that all the time. But if it comes to client experience or clinical care, yeah, you could find me.
We had a guest on one time and he said, it's not about the small things or the big things. It's knowing the important things or the not important things, because small things can be important and big things can be non-important.
That is true, yeah.
You know, yeah. As you look at it. The other thing that struck me in terms of the thing is very much keyed on sustainable growth within the business. And I mean that as in repeatable growth as opposed to the, but you do believe that it has to be clinician-led. Why is that?
100%, yeah. You can't, I understand, I know I'm on a business podcast here, but it's, if you run a veterinary practice or any healthcare, I'm not saying a veterinary practice, but any healthcare business, if you run it with figures first, the right decisions will never be made, because it'll be about the wrong reason. You're chasing numbers and not outcomes. So we chase outcomes. We chase getting pets healthy or arriving at a diagnosis. And like Nelly, you know, we chased an outcome, which was to get a diagnosis to what was wrong with her. And we found out what was wrong with her, which wasn't what we wanted to hear. It was a terminal illness. But we got the outcome and we were able to decide the path ahead, the few months ahead that followed. And if you do that and you do it well and you do it right and you do it as quickly as the patient or the client allows you to do it within the bounds of intervention. Some clients don't want heavy intervention, some want all the intervention. So you're working with a lot of personalities. But if you obsess over getting the right outcome or getting an outcome that and communicating with the client, the finances and the figures and the spreadsheets or whatever it is, they'll all take care of themselves. And that's where being clinician led is so, so important, is that we can make those decisions, and we'll make it with being business educated and understanding the impact that a clinical decision will have on the commercial aspect of the business. But you're doing it from the right place. You're starting in the right place, and if you do it for the right reason, the rest of it will take care of itself. And I think that's really, really important. And there's a lot of bigger groups, much, much bigger groups with hundreds and thousands of clinics across the world, and they have done it the opposite way around. And when you see the impact of that, the impact on outcomes for pets, on impact on the teams that work there, it's not who we want to be.
How do you deal with change?
The only thing that doesn't change in Village Vets is change.
Right.
I suppose we've been always chasing the sort of or not chasing was the wrong phrase, but we've always been open to innovation. We've always been open to new treatments, new modalities, new equipment, new ways of doing things. So as a result of that, change happens.
Yeah.
Some of them have been harebrained and worked. Some of them have been harebrained and bombed without any clinical impact, but sort of more sort of innovative ideas or ways of delivering the service. But yeah, we've changed. We are very open to change. We manage it carefully. We communicate. Certainly in the early days, I would have probably come in with a I've got this mad idea, and let's just do it, and everyone else would be running after me. I'd become better, I'd become more mature as I got more grey hair. Yeah. And
you get somebody else to run in with that idea.
I think we'd probably do a bit more planning before we launch. My home clinic is in Dunboyne, where we would have launched a lot of the new ideas and new initiatives and sort of maybe new communication tools or clients or whatever it might be. And that became the guinea pig, ground zero for a lot of stuff. And they either love us or hate us for it. I'm not too sure. It depends on what the initiative is.
And in the same way then, how do you deal with setbacks?
It's a challenge. You know, I'm very competitive. I like to get it right. I don't like to lose, but we've had setbacks throughout the lifetime of Village Vets, and we've dusted ourselves down, we've pulled our socks up, and we've got on with it again. You know, put a brave face on and go back out and face the music, and that's a tough one, especially as a CEO. You know, where we have a range master cooker in our kitchen at home, and there's a silver rail that we hang the kitchen the tea towels off. Yeah. And I have spent a few times sort of leaning up against that with the rail in my hand, talking to my wife, going, I don't know what to do here. You know, I'm
talk me off the cliff.
you just have to go back out there and get back on the horse. So resilience has a huge part to play in that, and I think that's we've always seen ourselves as the scrappy underdogs facing up to multinationals coming into the country. We're Irish based, we're clinic led, we're very clinician led, we're very different to other multinational veterinary groups, and we have taken them on in our backyard, and we'd like to think that we're giving them a good run. And you know, there has been setbacks off the back of that. And I think that has probably emboldened us even more to get it right the next time.
And as you step back and look at it in so far, how do you feel about what you've already achieved in the company?
I'm really proud of it. I'm really proud of what we've built in terms of that. Those clinics standing on their own, all the clinics that we have standing on their own every single day, doing what they do and wanting to do more, wanting to do better. We have a leadership team there that I couldn't be more proud of, that have come up through the ranks and are as passionate as I am and as passionate as I was 20 years ago. And I don't stand back very often and look at it, and it's kind of a question that you're kind of putting me on the spot about, but it's seeing that and seeing what we've come from and where how galvanized we are in trying to achieve what we're trying to do here, and what we're trying to build. And it's lovely to see everyone on the same page, and there's no egos, there's no one in the room that's bigger than the other, you know, and there's no one afraid to call me out if they think I've made a bad decision. You know, we get on. There's a huge amount of camaraderie, and there's a huge amount of respect for each other, holding each other to account.
And do you celebrate your wins?
Not enough.
As an organisation and in your own, from your own perspective?
As an organisation, as clinics, they do, yeah, absolutely. I think as a leadership team, not enough. And we do, we have a leadership meeting every Tuesday afternoon. And first thing up is on the agenda is the wins for the week. But we don't celebrate them enough. I don't think we oftentimes you go into, okay, that's great, but okay, what are the issues that we have to fix? I think that's, I think that for me, I think back to sort of, I do sports outside of work, and when I get sort of coaching, from coaches every now and again, and they'll always start off with, this is what you're doing really well. And in my head, I'm smiling, but I'm grinding, just get to the stuff that I'm not doing. Just get through it. Come on, this is all waffle. I want to get to the stuff that I can improve. Yeah. What did I not do well? And that's a personality trait of mine that I am aware of now and I'm trying to get better at.
Who do you seek advice from? Or who have you sought advice from?
A multitude of people. I started reaching out to people on LinkedIn probably, I don't know, not 10 years ago, but just shy of that, and asking to meet for a cup of coffee with no particular agenda in mind initially. And then after a while, I started having particular issues. I just started reaching out to people, and I'd say 8 out of 10 didn't respond. One would respond with a polite, not for now, thank you. And then one would say, yeah, no problem, meet you for coffee. And I've met some wonderful Irish business owners, Irish entrepreneurs who are so generous with their time and their advice. And then I started in the veterinary sector, going out to veterinary groups in the UK and in the States, just knocking on doors and saying, how are you? Can I come and have a chat? And then I was very lucky to be part of the EY, be a finalist in the EY Entrepreneur of the Year, and got some great friends in that who can bounce ideas off. My dad has been a huge source of support, or been just to bounce ideas. And then we have a wonderful chair of the board, Deirdre Burns, who's had a huge amount of experience across multiple different sectors, including veterinary. And she's been a great source of support and ideas and holding me to account and being honest with me.
Mm-hmm. What advice would you give to young people? Career advice, life advice, take your pick.
Do what you love. Chase that first. Make sure that what you do, that you want to get up in the morning, every morning, and do it. And I am very lucky to say that every morning that I get up, I look forward to going to do my job. I still love it. I think that's so important. And every now and again, for whatever reason, there might be some issue in work where I mightn't just love it as much, and it makes me realise all the other days of how much I do love it. And I oftentimes think when I'm driving into work, imagine if I felt like this every single day going to work, this would be awful. And thank God I don't feel like that. And the second thing would be back to what we just spoke about previously, is reach out and talk to people and grab a cup of coffee. The amount of inspiration, advice, ideas that I have received from other people by just doing that, by looking them up on LinkedIn, sending a letter, and the amount of people who opened their doors for no benefit to themselves and sat down.
I think it's, and this has come up loads of times on the show, I think it's actually a particularly Irish trait that, and we've seen it, so many people have been interviewed, you say to them, there's very, very few people out there, if you pick them up and ask them to go over a cup of coffee, that'll shoot you down straight away and say, no, not interested, don't bother me again. It might be, as you say, I just can't do it now, whatever it is. But eventually, there is just a natural it's a natural precondition to say, yeah, absolutely, I'll have a word and I'll have a coffee with
you. And it's phenomenal. And people like are keen to help, you know. Like, obviously, you don't pick someone who's in competition down the road from you, but and it's that has been huge for me, and I couldn't underestimate that. And I'm trying to, my kids are young, but I'm trying to embody that into them, that no one is unreachable. My eldest son is into cross country athletics, and he's Michael O'Leary's kids are into it as well. And you'd see Michael O'Leary at some of the races, and these are in fields out in the middle of nowhere, muck up to your ears and rain coming sideways. I remember getting into the car one day and saying, that's Michael O'Leary, he's the boss of Ryanair. And he said to me, Ted said to me, do you think he'd talk to me? I said, yeah, I'm pretty sure he'd say hello to you. So Ted got out of the car without even saying anything to me, caught me and went over. And I was sitting in the driver's seat watching this conversation going on. That was fine. And Ted got back in and said, well, he'd asked me how the race went on and asked me how I was doing in school and so on and so forth. That was fine. And then a couple of weeks later, we're at another cross-country race, and we pulled into a service station, and I was filling the car with diesel. And Ted went into the shop, and I could see him talking to someone. I kind of looked over straight, and here he was talking to Michael Leary again. And as he was walking off, I remember you could hear them saying, "I'll see you, Michael, I'll see you, Ted." And I just, that was amazing. Like, you know, if people are keen to talk, they're keen to help, keen to offer advice. And I'd be the same. And if someone asked me a question I don't want to answer, I'd say, look, I'd prefer not to answer that. But no one's ever said that to me. I haven't asked them personal questions either.
And I'm not going to do it today. Tell me this. When you look back, has fear of failure ever been a driving force for you?
Yes. It's not the driving force, but there's always been that it doesn't influence what I do, but there's always that nagging, all that always there going, you know, keeps you alive, keeps you awake. It's a sort of an electricity that just taps you on the shoulder every now and again. And I think it's an important part of being, running a business, of being entrepreneurial, is that you have that, because it's going to work. And we're not going to let it die. We're not going to let it fail. We're not going to cock this up. You know, we've got to make it work. That is always there. And look, I've always had a small bit of imposter syndrome, you know, I think fear of failure is somewhere sprinkled in around there, that.
Yeah. Have you thought about an exit strategy?
For myself.
Yeah, yourself and the other equity holders that are in there and whatnot.
Yeah, look, I think we've always spoken about who's your number two in the organisation. So if you're the lead vet or a head nurse in the clinic, who's your number two? And for me, that escalates all the way up to me. And I speak very openly about it at the SLT, about, you know, trying to help them, groom them to take my job. Someone needs to take my job. And then it's not just one person. There's going to be multiple people that should be ready to take this, because I could get hit by a bus in the morning, and this organisation cannot be dependent on me. I've ran very hard at this for an awful long time, and I'm sometimes envious of the other people in the organisation who aren't CEO and they've a head of title. And I go, God, wouldn't it be lovely just to have one aspect of the business to look after rather than being at all. So, I'm happy to continue doing what I'm doing for the next 5, 6, 7, 8 years. I don't know how long it'll take. But I do want to, at some stage, when there's a succession plan there, that there's someone coming up behind me. There's people coming up behind me at the moment, and their time will come, and I'll know. I've delayed moving people into roles before, and I've learned from that. And when the time is right, when there's better people than me, I will step aside.
Mm-hmm. Right. We've come to the black book.
Here's the black book.
It is a real black book. Let's see what we've got. Okay. What one thing do you have to do each day before work to prepare for the working day? And it goes brackets. Ironing a shirt is not an answer.
Wow, that is a good question. What do I do every day apart from the routine family tasks? To prepare for work, look, I suppose it's a bad habit, but I check the phone before I leave the house and see what emails are waiting and also what's on the diary. I should do it the night before. I give out to the kids for not getting their school bag ready the night before, and then I'm the one sitting in the car outside checking the phone before I turn it on. I suppose I like to be efficient with my time. I like to be to manage my time well and not to have unnecessary meetings or unnecessary emails. I don't like being CC'd in an email because someone's trying to cover their ass. So I try and do as much stuff sitting in the car in the morning before I turn it on to get rid of it, so that when I do actually walk into the office that I'm productive. It's a very open plan office, but my own own personal office is at the far corner from where the entrance door is. And I like to be able to walk in and meander through the desks talking to everyone. And it might be, what do you do for the weekend? How's your child? Or how are you getting on with that issue? Did you hear from that clinic? Did you hear from that supplier? How's that? Did you fix that piece of equipment? Whatever it might be. And that could take me half an hour to get from the door to my office. It could take me 60 seconds, depending on the day. And if I've got a stack of emails or a stack of junk on my phone, that might make that journey shorter, and I don't like to do that.
All right. Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Charles Cosgrave. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe, or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks, and we will see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.